We're about to start our final shiur on Sefer Bereishit, but before we do so, I just want to give hopefully a short introduction. Some of the topics that we're going to discuss today are going to be topics that are sensitive in nature, that require a certain level of tzniut, a certain level of care and consideration when discussing topics such as these. These are issues of that we'll talk about that are part of kind of the flow of this shiur, which relate to issues of interactions between man and woman, between husband and wife, are things that are a question as to whether or not they should be discussed in this forum. And my wife and I spent a lot of time talking about it yesterday. I spent a tremendous amount of time thinking about it. And my feeling is as such. My feeling is that it's very much a part of Torah. To ignore it would be to ignore significant levels and layers of Torah that are integral to what's happening in the text and in the storyline. To ignore these issues would be ignore issues that are perhaps at the very core or the centerpiece of Torah, on whether it be on a level, and we'll talk about this next year when we talk about Sefer Vayikra, assuming that you're all still here after this conversation. In Sefer Vayikra, when we talk about how the Kodesh HaKadoshim is designed, it's called by Shlomo HaMelech in Shir HaShirim is the Chedar HaMatot, there's the bedroom, and there's two angelic figures facing each other. There's only two figures there, they're facing each other. There's an intimate relationship that's happening there in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. So too in our own internal Kodesh HaKadoshim, it's something which is very central and integral to us, our relationships, particularly the relationship between a husband and a wife. It's something which is inescapable in Torah on that level, on the level of the deepest of all places, the Kodesh HaKadoshim, on the level of the fact that both in Nigla and Nistar, in the revealed Torah, in Chassidut, in Kabbalah, it doesn't matter where, even just taking the Rambam as an example, when talking about when the Rambam organizes his magnum opus and codifies all of the way that Judaism works in the context of taking the Gemara and putting it into the Arach HaZaka. He has one sefer there called Sefer Kedusha, and it only talks about two things. It talks about the relationship between men and women, and it talks about food. Why those two things? I mean, many other shirms that we give him, we'll also talk about those things later this year. But if we're going to talk about Kedusha, if we assume that we're an Am Kadosh, then these things are essential to who we are. That being said, that puts us in a very difficult situation, because we're in a midrasha. Right now, I am the primary teacher of the midrasha, and I'm a man. So how do we deal with those levels of tzniut and have proper boundaries and kedusha if there's both of those things happening at the same time? And I made a mental jump, which I imagine my rebbeim would probably not agree with, especially since I'm basing it off of them, which is that one of the questions that's raised is, why in our generation do we discuss Kabbalah? Many quote the idea, the concept that Kabbalah is something which should not be learned until one is 40 years old. Why do we do it earlier? And one of my rebbeim says, I won't quote him because I'm going to use this as to jump to a place which he certainly wouldn't go. He says that one of the many reasons why it's important in our generation to talk about Kabbalah, even at an earlier stage, is because we have such a thing which is crazy in our generation called pop Kabbalah. Kabbalah is part of pop culture. Kabbalah is part of our nature. There's Kabbalah centers. There's Kabbalah in the media. There are people who portray themselves as being the bearers of Kabbalah when they stand to be the antithesis of everything that Kabbalah means and stands for. And so if the choice is for those who actually carry it to not speak about it, because one should not necessarily do so at such an early age, and to therefore let the only exposure to Kabbalah be from distorted, broken sources, or to, at a certain level, to do it at an earlier stage, because better to hear it earlier from a proper source than to only hear it earlier from an improper source, to get a proper mindset, a proper orientation to these concepts, and that's the way that it should be. And I, at this particular moment in time, and I'll be judged for this in around 6 days, 5 days, 6 days, at this particular moment in time, I feel very strongly that from what I've seen from talking to Chatanim, from what I've seen from what my wife has expressed to me when we talk about when she talks to Kalot, from what I've seen talking about to married couples, to young people who are dating and all these things, our generation is seeing some of the most broken place in the place of relationships between men and women, physical relationships, and all of these types of things are in a very, very broken, distorted, and damaged place. And again, I take this on myself. I will be judged after 120, or I will be judged in a few days from now. I take that upon myself. I think that if we all come to these issues in a way where we talk about it in a way that's tsanua, we talk about it with kavod, we talk about it with a place of respect, we recognize the boundaries that exist between us and should exist between us as a male educator and a midrasha, I think that there are things that we shouldn't ignore. However, I respect the fact that not everybody may agree with me. If you feel uncomfortable by any of these topics, and this is only one day where we'll be talking about these topics, they'll come up a few times over the course of Sefer Bereishit, you can feel free to come to me and express that concern, and I will rethink it and maybe take a different route. I'm happy to do that. This is an experiment. Additionally, if you're not comfortable coming to me, which if the topic is uncomfortable, then it may not be comfortable to come to the person who's making you uncomfortable and tell them that they're making you uncomfortable, right? That doesn't necessarily help everybody. Ricky has graciously agreed as part of the Midrasha team to be available, that if you'd like to express your concerns to her so she can anonymously express them to me, that's also an avenue open to you. I want to be as respectful of all of you as possible. If we're going to do this, I want to do it right. And I want to do it properly, and I don't want to put anybody in an uncomfortable situation. But I don't want to ignore parts of Torah. If we can, I don't want to ignore parts of Torah that I think should not be ignored and I think need to be addressed in some way, shape, or form in a proper setting, in a proper mindset in this generation. Another possibility is an aside. In the future, it might be that Shoshana may sub in for me during these types of shiurim if she has more advanced notice than a day. We're going to try to plot those out if that may be another option as a way to go. I'm pointing out to you, and again, you may be like, wow, we didn't really even touch on so many things that are uncomfortable today. This is just one day where this stuff is going to come up. If you ever feel any line is crossed, speak to me, speak to Shoshana, speak to Ricky. If there are issues in it that you feel were not covered to their fullest because I couldn't speak as fully as I'd like to speak, speak to Shoshana and follow up with her. She's here as much as a resource to you as I am. Or you can follow up with me in the proper context in the proper way. I'm also here as a resource. But I just wanted to set the stage. I didn't want to blindside anybody, and I want people to know that this is a work in progress. Why I feel so strongly about this, but why I'm also open to any comments, feedback, especially if it comes from a place of discomfort. If you just disappear from the Midrashah and I find out a year later that you left because I made you feel uncomfortable, I will be very upset. There are too many opportunities to express that discomfort in a way where I can scale it back. Is everybody clear on that sense, on that concept, on where we're holding? If anybody would like to say something, they can. The idea is here not to force anybody to say something in a way that they don't feel comfortable. If you do have any concerns, you're free to express them to me, to Ricky, to Shoshana, to whoever you feel comfortable expressing them to. Okay? Good. Now we'll get to the heavy stuff. Okay. Last week, we left off talking about the Eitz HaDaas Tov V'Ra. In that context, doing a very quick recap, bullet points here, because at this point it should be ingrained in our minds. We've been spending far more time on Bereishit than I thought we would spend, and we're moving faster through the next parshiyot. We had the 7 days of creation. We discussed the fact that a process of six leading into seven is always a process of creation leading to completion, becoming leading to being. And so if the second narrative of the creation of man, if the Gan Eden story takes place on the sixth day, something must be created on the sixth day that's brought out by the second narrative. And what we defined as the creation on the sixth day that's brought out by the second narrative in Prakim, Bet, and Gimel is the creation of free will through the eating of the Eitz HaDaas Tov V'Ra, which we talked about what Eitz HaDaas Tov V'Ra means and eating means, that there is now a complete, full connection between man to his Tov side and his Ra side. They both exist within him because also, as is indicated through eating, taking something from the outside, taking it in, like we talked about, Chochma, Bina, and Daat, taking it in, chewing it, processing it, Bina, chewing it and processing it, and building something out of it, understanding what it is, pulling out the nutrients, the good from the psolet, taking out what he wants from it, and then da'at, becoming fully integrated in the person in the sense of food. It becomes a part of oneself. It nourishes one's body and one's soul. It becomes a part of one's body and a part of one's soul. That we have a complete connection now to Tov and Ra. I have Tov parts of myself and Ra parts of myself. And that is the inevitable outcome of free will. That's what happens as the person who the Rebbe who shared these shirim are based on, Rav Amos, my Rebbe, he points out is that's what needs to finally come to its completion within the womb of the world, which is Gan Eden, and then man can finally be birthed out into the actual history of the world once he has free will as a part of his life, once he's created in that balance between good and evil, between Tov and Ra, in order to make those free will choices and go out to history, as we talked about. If the process of the 7 days of creation leads us to the perfection of the physical world, the process of the 7,000 years of history brings us to the perfection of humanity, human society, human culture. We talked about that way back a few weeks ago, only three shiurim ago. Right? That's 7,000 years. How does that happen? How do we get to a place where we work to achieve a perfection of the human condition through our free will choices? That's all of those pieces coming together. Questions up until now? This is just recap. Good? Mm-hmm. Excellent. There's one deeper layer that we didn't touch upon. In terms of taking the words, Eitz Hadaat Tov V'Ra. Eitz Hadaat Tov V'Ra. We talked about Eitz Hadaat Tov V'Ra as being a process where we're ingesting, we're taking in, we're getting a complete and intimate knowledge and connection to both Tov and Ra. They're two separate, distinct things, and we have both sides of ourselves. There's another way with which to understand, or another layer with which to understand the Eitz Hadaat Tov V'Ra, which is a da'at between Tov and Ra itself. Tov and Ra also become intimately intermingled with each other. What does that mean?
The third option?
What?
Like a third option?
No, it's a deeper layer of looking at what we talked about before. Let's give an example. Let's see if this clarifies. You are walking through the street. You're in Israel. It's a Thursday afternoon. People are coming out of the shuk, and you see a sweet old lady walking out with her cart, wheeling it out of the shuk, and she's trying to get it onto the tram. And so you, any of you, run over, and you help that old lady get her cart onto the tram. You want to do a chesed, you want to do a mitzvah, she needed help. You go home that night, you think to yourself, I'm such a great person, look at the wonderful thing that I did, you feel really great about yourself, you go to sleep, but you wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning in a cold sweat. And you think to yourself, did I really do it to help her? Or, since my boyfriend, who I went into Shana'alith with, right, who I was there in Israel with, he was standing next to me, maybe I really wanted to make a good impression on him. And because he was there, that's why I ran over to help the woman get the cart onto the tram, was because I wanted to make a good impression. I wanted to have a positive impression on the guy. And you start to struggle with that. What were my motivations? What were my intentions? So the next week, you're right back there in the shuk. Your boyfriend's on a trip with his yeshiva somewhere else. So you're just happily walking through the shuk. And who do you see but the same old lady walking there with her car trying to get onto the tram again? She's very consistent. Right? So you run over, and what do? You help her onto the tram. You come home, you look in the mirror, you think to yourself, it's so great today. I did it just for the old lady. That was it. That's why I did it. There was no guy there. There was no other motivation. I'm totally good. You go to sleep. What happens? In a cold sweat. Why did you wake up with a cold sweat at 4 o'clock in the morning?
Because you know that you did it this time just to prove to yourself that last time you didn't do it just for your boy.
Exactly. Did I do it this time? We might have experienced this before. Then we have that, which is a very, very deep question. I didn't do it to impress him, but did I do it to impress myself? Did I do it to tell myself that I'm really a good person? Or did I do it truly altruistically for that other person? Those are deeper and deeper layers of getting closer to oneself. The experience that we have all of the time on the innermost chambers of our being, those of us who are self-reflective, is all about untangling conflicted motivations. Because not only, most people don't act with evil, and most people don't act with pure good most of the time. There was once, without getting into the details, a favorite writer of mine who was writing about a particular scenario, and this group that had named themselves a really evil name. And he said that in his story, he wasn't going to actually let them call themselves by that name. He says, because like, nobody wakes up in the morning and says, I'm going to be sinister today. I'm going to be evil today. Nobody thinks that. Everybody thinks they're valid. Everybody thinks they have a reason why they're doing it. I deserve this. I was wronged. There's a lot of reasons to have motivation to think I'm doing what I'm doing and why I can validate it to myself. But what happens is that Tov and Ra have a da'at between each other. So not only do I have a Tov side inside myself, and not only do I have a Ra side inside myself, but the Tov and Ra sometimes I can't even distinguish between them as they exist within me. My motivations can become conflicted. That's a much deeper layer of avoda. That's a much deeper layer of choice. The way that my Rebbe puts it, he says, compare it to like an onion. That every time you peel away one layer, you get to one more deeper layer each time you pull away a layer. He did not see the movie that you're all laughing about, I guarantee you. That's the example that he gives. But the way that he puts it in a more practical way, I was wondering if anybody would catch that, but he did not, is every single day that I think about one of my motivations when I'm doing something, every day that I peel away one more layer of ra, one more layer of negative motivation, that day I can look and say I'm one step closer to tov than I was yesterday. But that leaves the potential for tomorrow to peel away one more layer of ra and get to one more layer of tov within myself. One more layer of altruism. One more layer of selflessness. One more layer of pure giving. That's my goal. That's what I'm trying to achieve. That's the idea of the Eitz Hadas Tovara existing in us in a complicated way. Inside. Any questions about that so far? We had to have a little bit of a preface beforehand, so we might have a little extra minutes. I apologize in advance. Yeah. Good? Everybody's conflicted, confused, dually motivated? Okay. I'm not sure if they want to raise their hand. Am I really raising it for me? Am I raising it for somebody else? Yes.
Are we supposed to ever be able to fully distinguish between them?
The goal is to continue to work on that, and it's a lifetime's worth of work. It's a lifetime's worth of work to really distinguish and to immerse oneself in tov. To immerse oneself in selflessness, in pure giving, to be a pure reflection of godliness in this world. That's an avoda. That's a lifetime's worth of work. When we now move out of Gan Eden, the next character that we meet is Cain. Cain himself is a complicated character, perhaps even an overtly ra character. Cain is the first murderer. Let's take a look at the first pasuk that's described about Cain. Perek Dalet Pasuk Aleph. Va'adam yadat chava ishto, va'tar batilet et Cain. Man and woman had a physical relationship, and the woman became pregnant, and she produced Cain. Now, Rashi picks up on this. Maybe one of you will. We can leave a quick moment, just if anybody has any quick thoughts, because we want to be sensitive to the time. What's weird about the phraseology of the Hadam Yada Chava Ishto? How might we have anticipated that being phrased?
Like, he knew his wife.
Simply syntax. Phrasing. Order of the words, even. How do you say God spoke to Moses saying? It's like half scheme in the Torah. Okay, so how should this be phrased then? Rashi, Chazal all pick up on this, and they assume here that the reason why the syntax is changed is because Va'adam Yadat Chava Ishto means, as Rashi says, Kvar Kodim Ha'inyan Shalmala. This happened before, and you can take a look at Rashi on your own. Rashi says this happened beforehand. There was a previous physical relationship between man and his wife that produced Cain. What's the previous physical relationship on a text level, or at least hinted to on a text level, that we're aware of? We spoke of this before.
She came from his side.
That's Peseder. Good, but that's there's no conception happening there.
We're not saying previous to now.
Meaning previous to Perek Dalet.
So 9 months ago. No, they're saying now comes Cain. So it's saying the previous.
Where on a text level do we see an indication of a physical relationship between men and women?
When they were Aru.
Excellent. Take a look at Perek Bet. Pasuk Chafei, the last Pasuk in Perek Bet.
You're
translating the Pasuk. Yes. Take a look at Perek Bet Pasuk Chafei. Vayushnehem, well, the first is the pasuk that indicates the fact that there should be a loving relationship between a husband and a wife. That's pasuk chaf dalet. Al ken yazov ish et aviv ve'et imo v'davak v'ishto v'ilu basar echad. Therefore, a person should leave the house of their mother and father and cling to their spouse and become one flesh. The next pasuk, which is coming directly out of that, indicating that physical relationship that's taking place, vayushnehem arumim ha'adam v'ishto v'lo yiposhashu. Both of them were not wearing any clothing, man and his wife. V'lo yiposhashu, they were not embarrassed. Even the indication of the word embarrassment there implies to us that something complicated is happening there. Why is there embarrassment? If something's potentially wrong, but they weren't embarrassed, because they weren't supposed to be embarrassed? Should they have been embarrassed and they weren't? Something already there seems odd and conflicted. And watch the progression of the three psukim. Man should go, leave his house, and cling to his wife. Then the two of them were not wearing any clothing and they weren't embarrassed. Then the next pasuk, v'nachash haya arum, same word, mikol chayat hasadeh asher asa Hashem Elokim. Then the nachash emerges. What Chazal pick up on this, Rashi also reflects this, is that it's very possible that on whatever level, and when we talk about Adam HaRishon, we're talking about on the loftiest levels that there are, we can talk about Gemaras that will blow your mind about the loftiness of Adam HaRishon, and we're learning examples from Adam HaRishon for ourselves based on our level. Adam and Chava somehow, in that physical relationship, might have had different, conflicting motivations in the nature of that relationship. And there are multiple layers to what a physical relationship can contain. Some examples, some of the simplest ones, pru urvu, the, let's call it, and there's a much more complex system at work here. We're going to present it in its simplest form. We may or may not unpack it more over time. You will definitely should and must unpack it at some point in your lives when you get to the point when you're taking college classes and you don't speak to Shoshana and she'll help you unpack it. But there are different motivations involved. One of them is pru urvu, which in our simple presentation is the intent to repopulate the world, to bring more souls into the world. Let's call that, for simplicity's sake, an altruistic reason for two spouses to be together. A non-altruistic reason is for pure, selfish, hedonistic pleasure. Now, this is where things get more complicated. For another time, in a different context with another person, all physical pleasure in a physical relationship is not us or it's not bad. That's part of the negative view of it that we have in this world that's tainted by other religions and other pieces of culture. But for our purposes, we're talking about strictly complete selfish motivations for physical pleasure. Are negative ways to go into such a relationship. There's a third level also, which is actually indicated by the text, which is v'davak b'sholim v'ilosarachad, which implies just a relationship of love. There's an expression of love that comes in a physical relationship in the proper context and the proper time. But we're going to take these two, assume that there's some sort of dichotomy here. On a simple level, there's an altruistic reason of repopulating the world, and then there's the selfish reason of selfish hedonistic pleasure. And it's possible that in that relationship, those two things became intermingled. There began to be a mixing up of tov and ra. And the nachash, whether literal and physical, or perhaps more metaphysical and internal, begins to emerge. The nachash is an embodiment of the Yetzer Hara, of the Malach HaMavet, of the Satan, of the Sitra Achra, emerges, and things start to break down. Because the negativity is entered into the system, the selfishness is entered into the system. Many sources in Chazal also tell us that on a deep way, the thoughts that a person has in one's mind at the time where a child is conceived deeply impact the spiritual nature of the child. Sources throughout Chazal. If that's the case, and there were conflicted motivations in the relationship between Adam and Chava that might produce two very different and distinct results. If we were to give names to those results, what might we name them? Cain and Hevel. Totally different perspective on the story. Cain and Hevel as being the products of the two sides of the conflicted da'at tov v'ra motivations within Adam and Chava at the time that they were together and conceived the children.
Good.
I'm just wondering, like, if that's like forever for the child, like, it's going to be that spiritual whatever. Like, is that forever? Or just...
It will define the parameters of a person's struggles in this world. Even with Cain, when Cain first seems to be going down a dark path, God says, it's up to you. What's the key word? What's the word of all of history that we've been talking about? Bechira, or in this case, it's up to you. What should you do?
Choose.
God says, choose. Make a choice. The nature of his choice may be defined by where he comes from. I don't think that Hevel ever had a choice of kill or don't kill. Cain, because of where he came from, had a choice of kill or don't kill. We're not predestined, but our struggles are impacted by where we come from. It's a lot to be mitbonin on in that fact, to contemplate on that fact, 100%. But we're also saying this to a room full of people who are sitting and taking their time to learn in Midrasha. So, you know, don't, whatever one might be thinking, like, recognize that we all make our choices and we have our growth in the way that we need to have our growth. That conflicted motivation produces Cain and Hevel. That selfishness can reflect itself, can produce itself in jealousy, in hatred, strong emotions that we see from Cain that end up leading him down the path to become the first murderer. Rabbi Reb Amos has an interesting presentation, which we won't discuss here, but just putting it out there as food for thought, as to whether or not selfish desire produces hate and jealousy, or whether at its root, jealousy and hate are produced by selfishness. Whether selfishness is produced by hate. He brings examples, a couple of other examples where we see where these conflicted motivations, the two are certainly linked. One of them in Nach is the relationship between Amnon and Tamar. Yes? Where Amnon is totally running after Tamar from a place of selfish desire. That selfish desire is not met, and he turns around and he hates her at the end of the story. A more textual level within Chumash, even from a few weeks ago, Parshat Ki Teitze. How does it open up? What's the opening of Parshat Ki Teitze? Eshet Yifat Tor. A man goes out to war and finds a beautiful woman, brings her back home, and if he decides to, because he desired her in the war, take her on as a wife. Now the Torah gives an allowance for that to happen, whatever the kashkafic ramifications of that may be, gives a context for that to happen. But the implication of the Torah itself is that it doesn't endorse that. Because the next two paragraphs are as follows. One is you take an Eshet Yifat Tor. The second paragraph, seemingly unrelated, but very much related, is what then happens if you have two wives? One wife that you love, and one wife that you hate. How do you work out the inheritance? Because a relationship of lust, a relationship of physical desire, leads to a relationship of hate. And if there's a relationship between those two and there isn't the love there, what gets produced in its most extreme form? What's the third paragraph?
Ben Sarumar
is the next paragraph. A child who, in the most extreme case, is an embodiment of that hate. The motivations are very intrinsic in that moment and can be incredibly conflicted. If they're not conflicted, they can have very specific results. If they are conflicted, they produce the conflicts that we have in our own lives, or are part of the basis of the conflicts that we have in our own lives. But we see that explicitly in Cain and Hevel. Let's fast forward and let's wrap this up soon.
Are you saying that Cain's a Ben Sora more?
No, that's the most extreme case. And Cain also, I wouldn't say that there were any pure motivations of either Tov or Ra in Adam and Chava. And he is given a choice. We go on to Lemech. Lemech is the next person that we meet as we continue on in Bereshit, and we now close out, Sefer. We're going to close out Parshat Bereshit in the next 5 minutes. The story of Lemech also embodies this story. We see later on in the Perek. Perek Dalet Pasuk Yotet. Vayikachu Lemech Shtei Nashim. Lemech now does externally what Adam and Chava did internally. Adam and Chava may have had, on a certain level, conflicted motivations. Lemech just divides his motivations into two people. He takes for himself two wives. Hachat Ada v'ashnit Sila. Ada and Sila, which Chazal, Rashi here again, quotes immediately on the spot. Lemech took one for the purposes of reproduction, and one wife, Sila, that was Ada, and Sila was specifically for the purpose of physical desire. She stayed in his shade to be available to him. Her name was Tzila, indicating shade. Rashi brings that down explicitly. It's brought out through Chazal. Ada produces two children, which makes sense because her purpose was for the sake of reproduction. We're calling it, in our simplistic paradigm, Tov. Good, proper motivations. Again, in our simplistic paradigm. She produces two children. One is Yuval. V'shima achad Yuval hu haya avi kol tofes kinor v'ugav. That's the second child. Where's the first one? There we go. The first one is Yaval, and he is the first shepherd. Great profession, very sweet. All of the big people in Jewish history were shepherds. Chazal also, on a certain level, can take that in a negative direction because they're watching the decline of man. But on a simple text level, he's a shepherd. What about his brother Yuval? He was a musician. Tremendously lofty things with music. Now Tzila accidentally gets pregnant as well. V'tzila gam hi yalda et Tuval Kain. She gives birth to somebody called Tuval Kain. You kind of see a little bit predestination in his name there. Right? Going down the wrong path, going down a similar negative path. Just to make sure, in case we were worried and we weren't sure. L'teish kol choresh nechoshi de barzel v'achot Tuval Kain ama. He produces all...
Weapons.
But the actual pasuk says that it was anything that was used made of metal. But Chazal immediately pick up on Rashi, immediately jumps on the fact that he was the first one to design weapons, to follow in the footsteps of his grandfather, Cain. So much so that Chazal understand the continuing story where Lemech seems to kill Cain, that Lemech with Tuval Cain, using his weapons, goes and accidentally kills Cain. It boomerangs right back onto Cain. Again, an expression of using those motivations in their negative way, the positive way and the negative way, and the ramifications of where that could lead. Lemech has two wives. He divides his motivations. His motivations on one side are intentionally and explicitly ra, and that produces more death and destruction in the world. And what we watch is, from the eating from the Eitz Hadas, to Cain, to Lemech, to Tuval Cain, a slow degradation, a slow deconstruction of humanity. Which culminates at the very end of the Parsha. We have 1 minute left. Culminates with the very end of the Parsha. Perek Hei Pasuk Aleph, Ze Sefer Tolot Adam, B'yom Bro Elokim Adam, B'dmut Elokim Asa'oto. This is the story of the generations of man. Now, this is not all of the generations of Adam. What we're doing now is we're taking one branch of Adam's tree, of his family tree, and we're tracing it for 10 generations. That's what Perek Hei is doing. We're tracing the 10 generations that take us from Adam to Mishnah Pirkei Avos and the Pshat HaPasuk Pesukim to Noach. And the Parsha ends with Noach. We're tracing one specific lineage, one strain within humanity that takes us from Adam to Noach, which is where our story is going to continue. And we're left at the end of Parsha with the Bereshit, with a very dark presentation of where man has come to, where he was sent out after eating from the Eitz Hadat Tov V'Ra with his Bechira Chavshis, the degradation of man as he continues to choose more and more and more and more Ra over Tov, to a place where we can have such a stark pasuk, which now stands out as we see it as the culmination of Parsha Bereshit, the end result of the choices of man at the beginning of history, as he leaves the womb of the world and goes into history. Perek Vav Pasuk Hei, Vayar Hashem, God saw, ki rabba ra'at ha'adam ba'aretz, that the evil of man was prevalent amongst the land. V'kol yetzer machshevot libo rak ra kol hayom. And the intentions of his heart were only evil all day long. Man's life was a life of ra by the end of Parshat Bereshit. We internalize the Eitz Hadat Tov V'Ra, we're given a choice, we live in the realm of Bechira. And the choices that are made over those 10 generations bring us to an abysmal place of rak rak kol hayom. And the question is, can we get out? What are the implications? Where does that take us? The answers to those questions will engage in Parshat Noach. Any questions before we conclude? Yeah.
Actually, I can ask you afterwards. Okay. I really just have a random question.
Good. Yes.
It does say that Tuval Kain's sister was Nama.
Yes.
So isn't she married to Noach, so then she's not Ra?
Somebody actually asked that question to my Rebbe in the shir that I have recorded of him, which this is based off of. I've been listening to shir for many, many years. This shir was given probably in 67. And he there said that, yes, that it's interesting that Chazal make that point. There's another Nahama in Tanakh who has more negative connotations, and it's food for thought. He didn't have an answer then. I don't have an answer now. But it is a fantastic question. Yeah.
So if man was already facing this big conflict between Tov v'Ra right at the outset, why not give them the Torah right away so that they wouldn't degrade to this point?
So we have to see what's going to be accomplished in Parshat Noach. What's the transition that the story of Noach gives us? What's accomplished in terms of the next stage of what humanity in the world looks like? And it will look very different once the world that we have gets washed away and a new world gets built up in its place. And we'll have to explore the ramifications of Parshat Noach as we see them. Akan. We'll pick up with Parshat Noach next on Thursday. Wednesday? On Wednesday.